Session number 9360, Reel 1.
Volkert's Reel 1. Could you tell me a little about your family background?
Well, my father was in the army and was stationed in India. It was in the days of the Raj. And I went out to India when I was 7 and was out there until I was 13. And then came back to England when he retired.
You went to school in England?
No, yes, I went to, when I was in India, we went had governesses and army schools, and when we came back, I went to a local school, you know, day school,
yes.
In Eton, actually, because we were living in Windsor.
I was not very fond
of schoolwork.
How did you find the transition from India to Britain?
Oh, well, that was awful, really, because, you know, we'd had such a wonderful time out there, and riding and... You know, we had our own horses and my own pony and marvellous weather, of course. So it was rather a blow to come back to England. I didn't take to it too kindly.
So you went to school until you were 18?
16. I left at school at 16.
And what did you do after that?
Well, in those days, of course, you know, one just lived a rather social life. I just enjoyed myself, because I wasn't working then. And when the war started, I joined the ambulance service. Of course, before that, I did learn to fly. When the Civil Air Guard came up, that was a scheme where you could learn to fly for half a crown an hour. I joined that.
Could you tell me how you first became involved in flying? How did it all begin?
I think... I went to Brooklands one day. It was a motor racing with some friends, and one of them had an aeroplane, and he took me up for a flip. And I got sort of hooked on the idea. Thought, I must learn. And also I did think there was going to be a war. I could see a war was coming, and I thought, well, you know, if I can fly, I shall be in line for a nice job.
That was 1938, by the way,
was
it?
Yes, 39.
So you joined a flying club, did you?
Well, you had to, yes. These various clubs operated the scheme, you see. And you joined the club and you did a course and took your licence and got a licence, an A licence. And as far as I can remember, I think you were given 20 hours a year, something, or 10 hours, I can't quite remember, free flying for a year, you know, to keep your hand in.
What was the cost of joining these particular clubs?
Well, I don't think you actually did, you know, pay to join. As you were what they call a CAG member, you were automatically a member of the club. You just paid for your flying, which came out very cheaply, of course, half a crown an hour. I think now it's about £50 an hour now or something.
So what sort of aircraft were you flying initially?
The aircraft was a Miles Hawk. To one of the Miles group of aircraft.
Was that easy to handle?
Oh, very, yes. Not difficult at all.
Do you remember what was the reaction to you as a woman flying an aircraft?
I suppose it was rather unusual in those days. I suppose people did think one was a bit odd.
So what sort of test did you have?
Well, at the end of it, when you'd done you had to do so many hours flying. And when they thought you were sufficiently proficient, you know, you were sent solo. And you had to do, I think, a 3 hours solo, I think. And then in those days, they just gave you a test. I think you had a sort of machine in the aircraft where you had to go up and do a circuit and landing. And that was it.
Not difficult at all?
Not difficult, no.
What were the instructors like?
They were quite sort of reasonable people in there, good fun.
How do you think they reacted to you as a woman?
Well, I think they sort of took it in good part. Yes, they, well, I think they just treated one like everybody, you know, like the men. Didn't make any, didn't give us any privileges or anything.
Did you take any passengers at all in the early days?
Yes, just friends. Take them up. And then actually after I'd done, after I got my licence with the TAG, I then decided I was going to take up flying as a career. And I decided, you know, I was going to get a, what they called in those days, a B licence. That was a commercial licence. But you had to put in then, I think, 100 or 200 hours flying. So I started then to put in the hours. And I had to do flying, and I flew all over the place, seeing friends and taking friends for flips and things. And but before I could complete the time, the war had started. I think I'd just done about 70 hours. So that was the end of that.
So you didn't obtain your...
I couldn't know. It was all civil flying was then finished.
Where were you flying to before the war started?
Well, I learned actually at Cambridge here, funnily enough. And then, as I was living at Windsor, I did the rest of the flying at, the airfield at Reading. Made the main flying from there.
So then you heard the news that war had been declared.
Yes, well then war had been declared, and that put an end to all civil flying, which was rather a shattering blow.
Do you remember your initial reaction to the news?
Yes, I was rather upset. However, I did feel, I thought, you know, then that it would only be a question of time before there would be some sort of organisation where one could fly during the war.
Yes.
But that didn't come about for, you know, for a year or two.
So what did you consider doing? Did you think of going into the forces?
Well, example? I didn't want to do that because I didn't want to be tied up, you see. I wanted to be available. So I thought I went into the ambulance service, the London Ambulance Service.
Could you tell me a little about that, how it operated?
Well, that again, we were based in various locations in London. We worked shift work. We worked three shifts, you know, night shift, day shift, early morning shift. And we had to be on standby for air raids.
Were you driving?
Driving, yes. Yes, they had two of us on, a driver and a sort of helper. But on the whole, I was very lucky. We didn't come in for any nasty work, you know. But I did that because it was something I could get out of, you know, on short notice. Yes.
What sort of hours were you working?
Well, as I say, we did a night shift from about, I suppose, about six or something, till about six in the morning. And then there was another shift from six to two, I think. Two to eight, something like that. There were three shifts.
How long were you there?
I was there, let's see now, it must have been 1940 to 1941.
How are you coping with the war now in London?
Well, it was rather rather gay, really, to tell you the truth.
How was it gay?
Well, everybody was sort of, you know, a lot of people on leave, and it was sort of one world of gaiety, except when one was sort of working. But, of course, there were air raids going on all the time. And my father and I lived in a block of flats called Park West. And I thought that, you know, it was a fairly sort of secure place. Air raids didn't worry me. I used to sleep through them, and a lot of people used to go and sleep in the corridors. But I don't know, I just thought I'd just take my child and stayed in bed. We did get a bomb one night. We got a bomb on the front steps, which a small bomb, which sort of blew in all the windows. But otherwise, we didn't have any trouble. Got bombs around us, you know, had bombs in the Edgware Road. And
what about rationing? How did you cope with that?
Rationing, yes, that was a bit of a nuisance, a bit of a bore.
What do you remember about it?
What do I remember about it? During then, during the war, it wasn't... I mean, the earlier stages then, it wasn't so bad. And I think we had meals where at the station, I can't really remember. No, at the early stages, it wasn't too bad, rationing. It was towards the end, it was... after the war, the rationing was the problem, really.
Presumably, as an ambulance driver, you would have to go and pick up the pieces of the victims after bombing.
After bombing, yes. But as I say, we were terribly lucky, and we never really had any... weren't called out. It was always the other shift that got caught it, you know. And we were just lucky, and we didn't get it.
So you were there until 41?
I was there till 41, yes.
And what happened then?
Well, then, of course, I'd been trying to... I mean, the ATA had been formed in 1940, I think it was. But all the first six... There were only six girls who joined then, and they were all very experienced. They had all thousands of... They were all been flying before... You know, licenses before the war.
How you actually heard the ATA had been formed and what you knew about it at that stage?
Well, I'd been sort of... You know, we all knew people in flying, and one just heard about it or read about it in the paper. I think we just knew... But the first lot of girls, you see, were all very experienced, and they got about 1,000 hours, and I'd only got 70 hours. But I wrote and applied as soon as I could, and was told, oh, well, yes, but we've no vacancies at the moment. You know, there only were six of them. I don't think Margot was in the first six, I'm not sure. I don't think she was in the second lot, I think.
What was the ATA doing in the
In the early stages, they were only allowed to fly light aircraft, like Tiger Moths. That's all they were allowed to fly. They weren't allowed to fly operational aircraft at that stage.
Were they based at Hatfield at that stage?
At Hatfield, yes. Yeah. And it was Pauline Gower started it. So gradually, of course, they started to take more people on. They took on another lot. And then suddenly I got a letter from them saying, would I come down for a test? Because it gradually got down to my level, you see, there's 70 hours. So I went down and had a test there, to Hatfield.
Was that quite a difficult test, do you remember?
No, it wasn't really. We just, one of the instructors, that was Ibbidge, her name was, Marjorie Ibbidge, I think, she just took us up. We took off and did a flying and a forced landing and a flying around, and that was it. And they said, well, you know, we'll send for you when we can, maybe another month or two. And that was about it, I think.
So no, it was simply a practical test?
Just yes. So I think six of us went down that time and took it.
So how long did you have to wait until they
called? I had to wait about a month or two. And then at long last, the letter came, saying I'd been accepted.
You must be very excited.
Oh, I was. I think I opened a bottle of champagne then. I saw the letters. I came in, you know. I came back from the ambulance station was pretty ghastly, you know. And I came back and I saw the letter on the mat from Hatfield, and of course I knew what it was then. So I think we went straight for the champagne then.
So then you went down to Hatfield?
So then we went down to Hatfield, yes. And then
where were you billeted?
I lived in the Stonehouse Hotel, which was right opposite the airfield. It's now been moved to Scotland, I believe. It's gone. They moved it brick by brick, but it was a lovely hotel right opposite the airfield. And had a very nice room there. And I remember I used to have you could have a fire in your room, but it cost you a shilling a night if you had a fire. Incredible, isn't it? And it was very handy, because you just walked across the road and you were there.
Were you quite comfy there?
Oh, beautiful. Mm. Yes, lovely. Lovely food. Lovely hotel. Anyway, it was really great.
So what happened when you first arrived? Were you issued with a uniform?
Well, we weren't at first, because we weren't really... We had to do a month's training. And we had to be accepted... You know, we had to pass a test then and
could you tell me about the training and the test?
Well, again, it was the same sort of thing. We just general flying... Enforced landings.
Which sort of aircraft were you?
We were on Tiger Moths then. Because at that stage, the more advanced girls had gone on to slightly more advanced aircraft. like Lysanders and Battles, but they still weren't allowed to fly operational aircraft. But I think during the months I was there, that rule was changed, and women were allowed then to fly everything. Because I remember they brought a Hurricane over from White Waltham was the headquarters, and one of their most experienced pilots, that was Winnie Crossley, was the first one to fly it. And we all went out and watched, and I remember somebody saying, look, there's history for you. But we were only allowed to fly Tiger Moths at that stage. It was very boring. And then we had to do a certain amount of ferrying, I think. And we flew these Tiger Moths up to Scotland, I think. I think that was before we were absolutely accepted. And then when we were accepted, then we were given a uniform.
Could you describe the uniform?
The uniform was very nice, very smart. It was navy blue with gold wings and gold stripes and a forage cap. It was very fetching.
Could you tell me a little bit more about your training? Who was training you, for example?
Well, it was Joan Hughes. I expect you'll be going to see her. Or somebody would go and see her, because she was one of the first you know, girls. And she was an instructor. And she did the training.
So how many hours would you do?
I think I did... I can't really remember, you know. Not an awful lot. I think it went by hours, really.
It's just practical, was it?
Practical,
you know?
Really, yeah. Yes. General flying and forced landings and cross-country. And I don't think we did any aerobatics. No, I don't think we did. Got on getting out of spins, and I think that was about it.
How did you find it?
Well, of course, we were so terribly keen, you see, and we found it absolutely marvellous. Couldn't have enough.
Any difficulties at all? Any sort of near accidents?
Not really, no. No. They're very simple aircraft, those. Couldn't really go wrong. And then once we'd been accepted, then we started ferrying. I think we had to be, I can't remember now, we had to be accepted first before we were allowed to ferry, and then we started ferrying Tiger Moths and Magisters light aircraft.
How did you actually know you were accepted? Did you have a...
Well, I think they more or less told us, you know. Yes, you're in. There were one person, did, one girl didn't make it. We were all terrified, we'd all be thrown out, you see. But I think five of us got through and one didn't. My lot. Wasn't suitable.
So then you began ferrying?
So then we began ferrying the light aircraft, yes.
Were you ever given any choice of jobs, or did you simply have to do what you were told?
Well, we had more to do what we were told. Yes.
So were you ferrying Tiger Moths again?
We were ferrying Tiger Moths, and most of the stuff was up to Scotland. And I know we had an awful session of sort of flying up to Scotland, coming down on the night train. And then, you know, got back and had breakfast and said, oh, we've got another Tiger Moth to Scotland. He'd be up again the next day. Went on for about a week. It was very exhausting.
I understand the journey back from Scotland could be...
Ghastly, yes. And we couldn't always get sleepers. I mean, sometimes we had to sit up all night. And sometimes in the corridor too, because, I mean, the trains were packed. That was the worst. It was all right if we got a sleeper, but you couldn't always get them. But I do remember the first time that I think we went up. I think that was when we got a lift back. I got a lift back in an Oxford, which was a faster aircraft. We flew Tiger Moth, you know, we had breakfast in Hatfield. And we flew up Scotland and we came back in the Oxford. And I think I had dinner in London that day and I thought, oh, that's terrific, you know, I can't believe it.
Could you describe some of your actual flights, you know, coping with weather conditions?
Yes, well, of course, weather was always a problem. We had a very good Met service at the airfield, and we knew what the weather was before we set out. We used to get what they call actuals, which was the actual visibility at the airfield. But, of course, weather being unpredictable, you never quite knew what you were going to come up against. We did have some rather nasty moments. But if the weather was bad, we weren't supposed to fly on. We were supposed to turn back. Of course, a lot of people didn't and finished up in hills. And
did you normally turn back or did you tend to fly on?
Well, it all would depend on it. You know, sometimes you thought you could get through. and you took a chance. Other times you turned back. But you had to fly in a certain amount of bad weather, really. Otherwise, you would never have got sort of delivered anything. You had to do a bit of it, whatever anyone said. But we weren't supposed to fly. We were always supposed to fly below cloud. You see, we weren't supposed to go, because we didn't have any radio in those days. So we had to fly below cloud, keep contact as much as we could.
What would you do if you actually did get into serious trouble?
Well, it was up to you to get yourself out of it. But I do remember once I was coming back from, I think it was, we were stuck in Carlisle. Where was it? Somewhere up north. And we had to fly. You see, I don't remember all these places. But I do remember we had to get back, and we were all stuck. We'd been stuck for days, several of us, with Spitfires. And there was a gap in the Pennines you could get through, you know, if weather cleared a bit. And you could sort of see this gap from sort of quite a long way away. And we were all sitting there for 2 or 3 days. And I got really fed up with it. So I thought, well, I'm going to have a go at this. And so two of us set off. And we made for this gap. And the weather, as you say, can roll in, you know, without any warning. And I was going through this gap, and I found myself getting lower and lower and lower. And I suddenly realised I was just skimming over the ground at about a couple of feet, you know. And so I thought, oh, well, this is awful. I mean, I couldn't turn because, you know, you're in a valley, and if you turn, so I thought, well, I'm going to just keep going. So I kept going. And I suddenly came out of it. And I looked round, and right behind me there was an absolute wall of cloud. The gap had gone completely. But I came out into absolutely brilliant sunshine. And all the way back, it was a, you know, a beautiful flight. But that wall of cloud was behind. And one of the other girls, Faye Bragg, she wasn't so lucky. She was just behind me, and she got in it, and she had to climb up above it. And she got in a real mess and had to turn back. But it was just luck for me that I just got through. I mean, another 5 minutes, and it would have been very nasty. But there's one or two occasions like that. And another time, I remember I was flying up to Scotland, and I also got in some rather nasty weather there, and I had to stick to the coast, you know, and just follow the coastline all the way up to Prestwick. And that was flying along just about the level of the coast. But, I mean, I shouldn't have done it, but you got to the stage when it got, you know, you couldn't go back. You had to go on. Sort of point of no return. There were one or two nasty squeaks like that.
Did you often have problems with the undercarriage and things?
No, I didn't have any problems with that, no. Sometimes I had one or two problems with burst tyres bursting, but I was fairly lucky and didn't just burst on landing at the end of the landing run and didn't cause any damage. Oh dear.
How long were you doing taxiing?
Well, we did that in between the ferrying jobs, collecting other pilots, you know.
Where from?
Well, from different airfields. Roundabout, you know, I'll just look here and see where I've been. Cowley, which was one of the main factories building Spitfires then. Of course, there's British Leyland there. And Cranfield, Odium, Prize Norton. Just roundabout, collecting the other pilots. But there wasn't a lot of that. It was more ferrying.
So what sort of aircraft were you flying this time? Tiger Moths all the time?
Well, Tiger Moths and Magisters, Miles Magisters, and
So were these aircraft very similar?
Yes, they were very similar, and they were open cockpits.
What was that like then?
Very cold, very chilly, no heating or anything of any sort. We had to wear, you know, flying jackets and flying boots.
Did you find the uniform sufficient to keep you warm at all?
Well, it was all right when you had the, you know, the flying kit, the, you know, special fur jackets and the boots. Wasn't too bad. But on long journeys, it could get a bit chilly, especially on these flights up to Scotland. But there were two other aircraft we got, which was a great treat, and the one was an Audax. And the other was a Hind, and they were a bit more advanced than the Tiger Moth.
Which ways were they more advanced?
Well, they were larger aircraft and more sort of power. Not you know, the others were very ordinary light aircraft. And I think six of us went off one day to collect these Ordex. These, I think they were Heinz, we went to collect, and we none of us had flown them before and hadn't sort of got any information about them. And I got into mine and I just sort of disappeared completely because the little flight sergeant had to go off and get a lot of cushions to pad me out so I could see what I was doing. But they were good fun to fly, and a bit more, you know, guts to them than the others.
So the fact that you'd not been taught to fly these particular aircraft, how did you cope simply from handling notes?
I think we had handling notes on those, yes.
Did you?
But we didn't get any dual on them or anything, because on the other aircraft, of course, we'd all gone, had, you know, dual flying. But we didn't on these. But they weren't considered to be, it wasn't considered to be necessary, really, on those aircraft.
Did you find the handling notes were adequate to enable you to fly?
Oh, yes, they were really marvellous, those notes. Absolutely wonderful.
So this continued for about a month, did it? And what happened after that?
What, the flying for the...
Taxiing and the
taxiing, no, that was about 6 months. That was about 6 months. And after that, that was in March. I joined in March 41. And we ferried up till October 41. And then I went up to White Waltham to do a conversion course to fly the more advanced aircraft.
Could you tell me about that? So you went off to White Waltham, did you?
Yes, we went out. I went up there to do a conversion course onto the more advanced aircraft. And I was then flying the Harvard, an American trainer. And I also had an American instructor, a bloke called Ben Warne. And we started off doing circuits and landings. Oh, before that, of course, I'd forgotten. We did have training on in the theory, you know, ground training, which was that went on for I think about a week.
Could you tell me about the training? So what did it involve?
Well, we were just given a sort of theory of flight and a bit about engines and things, different types of carburetors. Such a long time ago, you know, I can't really remember too much about that because I wasn't very good at it.
How many girls are doing the course?
I think there were about six of us, and of course the men as well, because, you know, White Waltham was a men's ferry pool. So most of them were women. I think there were about 12 of us in the class, something like that. Probably half the girls.
What was the ratio of men to women at that pool?
I think there were very few women there then. Probably only about half a dozen women there ferrying, I should think, at that stage, in 41.
What was the attitude of the men?
Well, of course, I didn't really know, because we weren't actually ferrying for them. I was an